TIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm Phil Taylor. First thing I want to say is thank you very much for all the support that we received. It's been a great compliment to the programming at the CIUT and an indication that we must be doing something right. And I want to say thank you very, very much. Our fundraising was a lot of fun and successful. And I tell you that today we're going to be talking about some obvious subjects. Well, one will be obvious. In the latter part of the show, we're going to talk about developments in the Middle East, the situation in Tunisia, the situation in Libya, the peculiar behavior of the American Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, not her finest moment, putting it mildly. And we're going to be talking at the beginning today with Dr. Belisario. I should look at that more closely. I think I mispronounced, but Belisario, pardon me. And he is a Cuban doctor who has been working in Haiti, a country that has been undergone so many terrible experiences, and it is such a fortunate thing that there are medical professionals who, together through the leadership of their countries and governments, have tried to help out in Haiti, and they've been doing rather remarkable work. And Dr. Tomas Belisario, I believe, is on the line now. Are you there, Doctor?
Yes, I hear well.
Thank you very much for joining us. By the way, you're speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Steelworkers Hall here in Toronto, 25 Cecil Street. That's 7:30, 25 Cecil Street. We hope many, many people attend. You've been touring a bit now in Canada. What brings you to Canada? What is the mission?
I mentioned tonight we are going to talk about the different experience we had in Haiti after the earthquake, because I belong to the Cuban Medical Brigade, Henry Riff, and have the responsibility to deal a field hospital at this place. Then we are going to talk about this experience and how we did in this condition.
And just to give our listeners an idea, incidentally, Cuba has been providing, prior to the earthquake, there were medical teams working in Haiti because it was, of course, an impoverished country with many, many difficulties. Were you associated with that work prior to the earthquake?
Yes. We have I don't know if you know, that the Cuban Medical Brigade is working in Haiti since 1998. And then, for us, as you know, we are working in a lot of countries in the Cuban Medical Collaboration. But Haiti constitutes an important priority for our country because the close friendly that we have for a long, long time. And then, at the moment of the earthquake, we had more than 300 of health workers working in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And then, at the first moment, a few hours later, after the earthquake, we arrived with the first plane and the help of a group of Cuban Medical Brigade, and forgive the help. And continue send them to the country a lot of hospital, field hospital, that we are installing in different places of the country. But it's, after the earthquake, we work a lot aftermath of the problem. And as you know, later we have to be in front of the cholera epidemic, and we have a lot of doctors working, but we send a group again because some of the Cuban medical collaborators had been gone back to Cuba, and then we send again another group to help, and then we open an important group of service for the treatment of the cholera. And now that this has improved the situation of the cholera, and not is finished, but it is improved a lot, we have more than 700 health workers in Haiti working today.
700. Now,
700 more.
More than 700.
Yeah.
And again, I'll remind our listeners, this is Dr. Jorge Balsero. He is a Cuban doctor, and he is speaking tonight, Monday, October 24th. It's 7:30 at the Steelworkers Hall at 25 Cecil Street. How does this – most of us reading about this, doctor, get the impression that it's a, it remains a somewhat chaotic situation. How do you coordinate? I mean, if you have 700 doctors there, are there other medical people from other countries, and how do you interact with them?
Look, yes, we have during the after the earthquake, we have a collaborating, and we are seeing a lot of doctors from several countries. And after the first moment of the earthquake, but usually this group of doctors. Are not stayed in the country for a long, long time and come back to their country. But today, we are the main group of doctors that we are contributing to to give the service and health cares for people in Haiti, because we are working in an important group of integral health centers. Mm-hmm. And another 15 communal regional hospital, and another group of doctors that they are working as a family doctor in the more far community that is around the different part of the country. Right?
Mm-hmm. Again, I would just keep saying it's Dr. Balsero, and he's going to be speaking 7:30 at Steelworkers Hall. That is tonight, Monday. It's at 7:30. I hope people will attend. That's 25 Cecil Street. Doctor, I've heard comments about situations such as that of Haiti where economists say, you know, the problem with in a poor country is if they have a natural disaster, they can't recover quickly the way maybe you might in a developed country or where there's more capital. I mean, you almost have to start from nothing, don't you?
You know, Haiti is a very, very poor country. Before the disaster, they had a very complicated situation, economical and not directly with the health system are very complicated. But after the earthquake, of course, this situation is the worst. And now, I think this country needs a lot of help to recovery, because the destruction of the structure of the country, especially in Port-au-Prince and some place near of the capital of the country, are very, very, very complicated. And then I think they will be need a lot of help. And actually, they didn't receive all the help that the countries promised to Haiti, at least until today. Mm-hmm. And then I think they have to work so much, the population of Haiti, the new government, and of course the help that they maybe they receive will be very important to develop the country, because if not, they will be for a long, long time in this situation that today are they suffering.
Yes. And, doctor, what about the – are you helping them get their own permanent medical capacity? Are you training doctors in Haiti?
Yeah. We have a... We are training doctor, Haitian doctors from Haiti in Cuba and in Haiti. But because we have in the faculty of Santiago de Cuba, an important group of doctors, students are studying medicine. And another group of doctors that are finished the career, are complete the studies, and then start to do the different specialties. Some of them in Haiti, for example, pediatrician, gynecology, internal medicine, and others is necessary to do in Cuba. But it's a responsibility that we are in the preparedness of the human resource for Haiti.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Dr. Jorge Balsero, and he works in Haiti. He's going to be speaking at tonight, 7:30 p.m., Monday the 24th, at the Steelworkers Hall at 25 Cecil Street. And, you know, Doctor, here in Canada, we hear your story. I saw you this afternoon at a press conference. You put me in mind of a famous Canadian doctor named Bethune, and literally, because you described conditions that you had to live under and work under, and when we think about the medical profession, we don't ordinarily picture somebody in a tent with barely anything to eat. Can you describe what it was like to get started there during this disaster?
Yeah, we have. I don't know. Do you understand well my bad English?
Yes, your bad English is excellent.
Good.
You have excellent bad English. Don't worry about it. That's fine.
Okay. Thank you. Look, yes, and when we arrived in Haiti, the situation is very, that I said before, very complicated, but the condition, and the first is a lot of number of people displaced of the because all the houses were destroyed. The sanitary environmental is very, very, very bad. Mm. And the sanitary structure, like service of health that they have before, are collapsed. Mm. And not food, not water, not power, energy. And that is a very, very, very complicated situation. And it's impressed a lot for us because, in Cuba, usually we are in front of different disasters like hurricanes.
Yes.
That frequently affected our country. But it is not the same thing. It is not the same thing, and the destruction was very, 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 very much. Mm-hmm. That we are usually there. Mm-hmm. And another country, for example, Pakistan, and another Indonesia, that we helped this country before, after the disaster, but in Haiti, the conditions that we are seeing is for the near of this country, we arrive very, very, very soon. Mm-hmm. And then in the case of the other country, we arrived late, and maybe some work they are start to do. But in the case of Haiti,
you were the first ones.
Yeah, it's very soon. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Is this a situation, right?
Yes.
I don't know. This is the answer that you ask.
Well, just that matter of you did literally have to sleep in a tent, right?
Yeah.
And food was hard, even just for your own. Intake, your own nutrition, it was difficult to acquire that.
Yeah. We have the accommodation condition to stay for the few minutes that we have time to rest are very, very difficult because we live in tents, camps,
mm-hmm.
and they are small. We have some of them for two persons. And the other is for six, and but we are living in this condition. I believe the first month was very, very difficult to get at least a couple of hours to rest. But we can do it, okay?
Yeah.
This is very hard for us.
By the way,
food, we have time. Mm-hmm. In the morning, we receive sardines and tuna in the afternoon, and the next day is in birth, you know, because...
one day you had tuna, the next day you had tuna.
Yeah. Tuna and sardines.
And it's sardines for
and
dinner.
And then we have a combination with rice, and this is the main food that we have during the first month, because the condition of the country, we cannot buy any other food, because it's very dangerous. After the hygienic and epidemiological condition, you know. And then, but after that, this time we can normalize and start to have a good nutrition. And it's an important thing for the brigade.
And you've turned this experience into, also this work into part of the training of your own students. Is that true? I mean, I understand, for example, I heard a questioner today ask you, it is the case that some American, that would be U.S. students who are in Cuba getting medical training, they joined in to go to Haiti to help out. Is that right?
Uh-huh. Well, let me tell to you that I don't know if you know that after we created the Cuban Medical Brigade, the internationalist Cuban Medical Brigade, Henry Reeve, in 1998, after the creation of the brigade, we made a special program of disaster medicines, and we gave a diplomate one and diplomate two, and we give training, theoretical and practical activities to be in front. Face to face with the condition of the disaster.
A diploma in disaster medicine.
Yes. And in the curriculum of the Cuban student now, they receive in fourth grade and in five is a course into the curriculum about disaster medicines for 6 months. You know, and then the normal doctor in Cuba receives, because in Cuba we are understanding that we cannot move the country of the place, and the natural condition, especially after the climate change that is occurring in the last days, is by day we as in front of hurricanes, each time more strong, and then we have to prepare our medical specialists to give the health service after disaster, because it's our special condition.
A whole new school of medicine as a result of the new kinds of disasters.
Pardon?
I said a whole new kind of medicine because of the rise in natural disasters.
Uh-huh. How many students? I don't understand the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was making a declaration about your work. This is Dr. Balsero, and he's going to be speaking this Monday, that's tonight, today, 7:30 p.m. at the Steelworkers Hall at 25 Cecil Street. And this is not your first meeting. You've already been touring Canada, haven't you?
Yeah. I have a lot before, because we start in Montreal and Quebec, later we stayed in Ottawa and Kingston, now here in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And later we will be stayed in Windsor, Edmonton, Vancouver, London, or a lot of places, more than 20 conferences across the country, because we are accepted the invitation of the Friendship group of Canada that want to share our experience with all people in Canada in this tour, and at the same time invite people to help Haitians people by directly throughout the Cuban medical building.
Yes, I understand that they have. I heard an announcement. I believe that so far that they have raised $300,000 towards helping underwrite all this work. So that is a great accomplishment. We congratulate you. Just the last point, if for you as a medical professional and your team, there must be a satisfaction in being able to have the skills that you have and to bring them to a place so desperately in need, like such as Haiti.
Yeah, of course. We can both things. The Cuban medical doctor will feel a very important quantity of satisfaction because they were on their duty accomplished. That is the most important thing. And at the same time, all the population of Haiti give us the satisfactions because the work that we develop in the country, and any time they are show us demonstrating different form of demonstrating of the gratitude for our work in this country.
Well, that's very good, and we're very glad you're in Toronto. I hope people will be there tonight, 7:30 at the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street. Dr. Balsero, it's a great honor to talk to you, and I hope you will have success for your future work. Thank you very, very much.
Okay. You're welcome.
Bye-bye. That's Dr. Jorge Balsero, and he is speaking tonight again. It's at Monday, October 24th, 7:30, Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil. There have been many successful meetings across the country already, and now it is coming to Toronto. It is a great story, and it's got so many dimensions to it. I hope people will go and attend. This is the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. You can check our website, taylor-report.com, and you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back, and we're going to be talking to Zafar Bengash.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. There's been, of course, all kinds of news in the Middle East. Much of it, I don't know how to describe it, macabre. And Zafar Bengash of Crescent International is one of the authorities on the region, knows its history. And so we're going to be talking about that. We're going to ask about this election in Tunisia, which has, in my mind, a lot of interesting elements to it. I probably will want to ask him why the Toronto Star is so interested in Tunisian election and celebrating it, with, since the Canadian government doesn't recognize Hamas, which was victorious in election in the West Bank and in Gaza, and Hezbollah was elected in Lebanon. Both these parties are recognized by their own people and by the other parties that participated in the elections with them. So to me, it's a paradox leading to almost to a joke for smug, satisfied, comfortable editorialists at places like the Globe and Star not to point out that we don't really respect democracy. I just interviewed a gentleman who has been trying to help save lives in Haiti. The Canadian government participated enthusiastically in removing the most popular elected president in the history of that country, and that would be President Aristide And he was told by Secretary of State Colin Powell he either had to get on a plane as directed by U.S. military personnel, or he would be thrown to the wolves. And on a small armed group had been escorted into that country and permitted to overthrow the government of Haiti. No effort, no worry about that on the part of anybody. So democracy went right out the window. So when our editorial writers tell us they like democracy, we should laugh out loud. If they respected it, they wouldn't have overthrown Aristide. We owe Haiti an awful lot of money for the damage done by the people who came into power there. And this is under the presidents Clinton and Bush and today Obama. When they talk about people, they put ink on their fingers and isn't that great? They're just tasting democracy. Well, if they choose the wrong people, we don't recognize them. I think what we'd have to say is our elect are more powerful than your elect, and we will tell you whether or not you can have somebody. For example, if people in Lebanon vote for Hezbollah, Canadians say, we don't recognize your election. If the people of Gaza vote for Hamas, we say, we don't recognize. There is an individual who deserves an awful lot of credit, and that is former President Jimmy Carter, who there seems to be a kind of a consensus not to listen to him. He has pointed out that the whole point of if you believe in democracy is that if you may or may not like who people have chosen, but once they do, then it's your job to deal with them. And in the case of the Canada and the United States, they do not accept the choice and of the Palestinian people. Incidentally, the Palestinian people, of course, have been under fire and under siege, and they have been they have all sorts of UN resolutions at their back, saying that the West Bank is being illegally occupied by the State of Israel. I don't see NATO doing anything about that. The Air Force of Israel has been used against the people of Gaza with very ugly results. And again, NATO sleeps on, cares nothing. So we seem to be having problems reaching Zafar. This is the Taylor Report. I think we'll take a brief break and see if we can solve the issue of locating him. He's a brilliant guy, and we do need to talk to him. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back. Now, I think we are getting in touch with, we have reached our good friend Zafar Bengash. He's the editor of Crescent International. He has traveled in the Middle East. He's been to most of these countries that we're going to be talking about today. And I'll just remind you again of the topics so that we want to make sure we get onto, such as the phony regard for democracy that we're seeing and the unctuous editorializing about, isn't it marvelous, the Arab Spring. The simple rule is that, as I understand it, is that you're free to choose who we like. If you choose someone we don't like, we are ourselves, this culture, this society is not in favor of democracy. As a matter of fact, we're dead set against it. We also really don't like independence very much. And we're proud of how, for example, NATO exists, and it's a wolf pack. And we see editorials here written along the lines of Canada's becoming a very important wolf in the wolf pack. The other wolves really think we're great. So we're supposed to all be pleased about that. Now we have Zafar Bengash. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
You see, we are dogged. We stay on. We want so much to hear from you.
Thank you.
Zafar, let me ask you first of all, let's just get your reactions. I saw the reaction of Hillary Clinton. She, at the death of Muammar Gaddafi, she first of all kind of laughed, and then she said, we came, we saw, he's dead. And then she and all of her staff laughed. And then we began to see all kinds of footage of the capture of the man, and then we see now pictures of his corpse and that of his son. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, it obviously clearly indicates the deep involvement of the Americans in this war on Libya, although it was couched in that Security Council resolution,
yes,
1973. But, I mean, that resolution cannot provide the fig leaf for this war, which was essentially a war of aggression, because even that resolution, illogical and illegitimate as it was, had only authorized the defense of civilians in Libya, not the murder of civilians in Libya, certainly not the killing of its ruler. Whether we agree or disagree, or whether we support or not support or oppose Colonel Gaddafi, the fact is that neither the U.S. nor its allies have any right to go and kill him. Now,
as a matter of fact, don't they have a duty to capture? I thought they said that he was a war criminal and all those things.
Exactly. They had, in fact, even lodged cases in the International Criminal Court, which, incidentally, the U.S. is not a signatory to, yet it always invokes that International Criminal Court. That the people that doesn't like it just simply goes and grabs them and presents them before that the ICC. And now, we clearly
this is a Clint Eastwood version
that's
of
right,
Law
exactly.
and Order.
Absolutely, yes. This is the old Wild West once again.
Yeah.
So what we saw, Colonel Gaddafi was taken alive. I mean, you know, we have seen video footage of it. There's
no question he was alive.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, the spokespersons for the National Transitional Council of Libya have been proved to be liars because they said, well, there was cross-firing. And he may have been killed in cross-firing. There was no such thing.
Isn't that rather shameful and almost shocking that they would start playing that one of the oldest games in the world, he was killed in a crossfire?
Exactly.
We all grew up hearing that.
Yes, exactly. And you know, we saw the footage. I mean, it was taken by somebody's, cell phone, but at least we got that on record that he was alive when he was taken when he was captured. Also, we know that he was wounded because he was, when the people dragged him from the top of a car and they brought him onto the ground, he was still walking initially. People were pulling his hair. Then, and he was being hit with rifle butts, etc. Then he was thrown to the ground and dragged for a while, and then he was shot in the head. I mean, there were even people shouting, "Don't kill him, don't kill him," you know, and you can see that. Obviously, he wasn't dead at that time, and when somebody said, "Don't kill him," obviously they did not mean that there was any cross-firing, and they were telling the other side not to kill him, because there was no other side.
By the way, can I ask you right now, too, while I'm thinking, we also saw his son, a prominent gentleman who not so long ago was standing at the White House, I believe, with Hillary Clinton, he was shown sitting smoking a cigarette, obviously a prisoner, and the next picture he's dead.
I want to clarify this matter a little bit. One of his sons, Moctasim, he has been shown to have been killed along with that operation that was carried out against Colonel Gaddafi.
Mm-hmm.
There were initial reports that his other son, Saif al-Islam, who is the more well-known internationally.
The public face of the family.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Because he studied at LSE in England. He got his PhD from there. He rubbed shoulders with the high and mighty in Britain, including one of the royal princes in Britain, mm-hmm. and a number of other people.
He knew Tony Blair personally.
Exactly. And
what more can be said?
Yeah, and the reports that I have read are that he was injured in that attack when Gaddafi's convoy was attacked by U.S. and French planes, but that he managed to escape. So we don't know whether Saif al-Islam, the public mm-hmm. face of the the former regime of Libya, whether he's alive or dead. I'm not sure which person is it that you saw smoking.
Well, we're living in this new age now where you can go and look at videos almost, you know,
instantly.
Yes. Amazing, grim, morbid material is on the internet about all this, and there is someone identified as his son, who they said was in charge of the security at CERT.
Right.
And he's in custody.
Right.
He's sitting in his T-shirt and,
right,
and shorts.
Yes.
And he's smoking a cigarette.
Right.
And then they show him dead.
I see. Then that probably is Saif al-Islam, because is he the one who sort of...
Not the one who went to Oxford. This fellow is slender with... he has a beard. He looks quite... He's not at all... You wouldn't know him to be a Gaddafi's son.
I see.
All this is getting so sad and strange,
right.
With these bodies being produced.
Yes.
By the way, in terms of treatment, there is a funny kind of ethnological exercise going on here. The Toronto Star and others are telling us, oh, well, that's the way they are, you know. That's no one in Libya cares.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you must know the story of Lord Kitchener when he went to take revenge on the Muslim leadership of
Sudan. Yes.
What did he do to the remains of their most revered leader? Do you know that story?
No, I'm not. I'm not aware of that story.
Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Well, my understanding is he actually had the body dug up and thrown in the canal.
In the river.
Yes. Yeah. But well, you see, denial. Yes.
Yeah. What they are doing with Gaddafi's body is completely contrary to Islamic laws and principles. Islam requires that when a person dies, that he should be buried as soon as possible with all respect. There should be no desecration of the body. There should be no humiliation or desecration of the dead, no matter whether he's your enemy or friend. This is not even permissible to the bodies of non-Muslims. Mm-hmm. And yet here we have these people who have not only refused to bury Gaddafi's body, but that they put it on display. I think it's a disgrace. It is completely contrary to Islamic principles, and the people who are doing it are violating all the tenets of Islam. And I'm sure that Muslims around the world will make note of that, because this is not something that Islam permits at all. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is something quite shocking, and I'm sure that people will... particularly Muslims would find it quite, unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Zafar Benghazi, Crescent International. And Zafar, if we were to tote up the final score of battles, did the rebels win a single battle without NATO Air Force?
No, not at all. You see, when they launched their uprising, it's one of those funny things that before that, what they had done was they essentially had sought the help of a number of people in the West, including this, French philosopher. He calls himself a philosopher, of course. Bernard Lévy. Yep. Who actually took the leaders of the...
VHL.
That's right, VHL, yes. Bernard and Henri Lévy, he took these leaders of the National Transitional Council to meet Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president. And he urged Sarkozy to agree to launch a war against Libya. And the words he quoted was to protect the civilians of Misrata, Sirt, and Benghazi. And, of course, the excuse that was made was that the civilians in Benghazi would be massacred by Gaddafi's forces. Nothing of the sort had happened. Nothing was planned. And using this as a pretext, the UN Security Council was mobilized to pass that resolution. And the two countries that could have prevented that resolution, as it happened in the case of a similar one last week over Syria, both China and Russia were railroaded into that resolution because they were told that this was only to prevent the civilians in Benghazi. Now, what we have witnessed is, and this is something that the BBC and other Western news sources have confirmed, that the city of Sirte, which is the birthplace of Colonel Gaddafi, it was besieged for nearly a month, and the BBC has confirmed that not a single building in that city is left intact. It was subjected to massive artillery bombardment, as well as NATO attacks from the air, and food, water, and medicines were prevented from reaching the besieged inhabitants of the city. The idea was to starve them into submission. And of course, the defenders of the city, who were supporters of Colonel Gaddafi, they fought to the last man. And this morning's news on the BBC, we have got that in one of the hotels, they discovered 53 bodies of Gaddafi's supporters whose hands were tied behind their backs, and they were shot in the back or in the head. And this is clearly done by the fighters, the rebels of the National Transitional Council. So we see that the new government in Libya is born in bloodshed and revenge and execution-style killings. And I'm afraid I have grave concerns for the future of Libya. But obviously that is something that the U.S., France, and Britain are not concerned about, because their interest in Libya was not the rights of the people or the livelihood of the people or the security of the people. They were after Libya's oil, as well as the fact that Colonel Gaddafi was trying to challenge their hegemony in Africa by making the African countries independent of Western manipulation and influence, particularly with respect to proposing that there should be an African monetary fund, that there should be an African central bank, which incidentally was going to be set up right there in Sirte, and we can see what they have done with that, that they have destroyed that city, and there is absolutely no possibility that anything like that would, this was going to be the African Investment Bank, and the African Central Bank was going to be set up in Abuja, Nigeria, and with an estimated capital of $42 billion, of which Gaddafi had pledged $30 billion, which, as we know, was the $30 billion deposited in U.S. banks that the U.S. government froze as soon as the attack on Libya took place.
Yeah, the theft began at once. They actually stole Libya's money.
Exactly. And I'm absolutely certain that despite the claims that this money would be made available to the new government, I'm convinced, I can say it, I've said it before and I will say it again, that the Libyan people will not see that money. Unfortunately, Western governments are not in the habit of giving money stolen from other countries. No, you know, they're not going to do that. And
there have been statements, by the way, and this is Zafar Benghazi. There have been statements made by leading political figures now in both Britain and the United States, and I'm sure France, because this is really the way Sarkozy sees the world, saying that Libya now will have to mark money from their oil to pay for all the effort that NATO put in.
Exactly. So, in other words, NATO went in to bomb Libya, and they're now going to charge the Libyan people for bombing them, for destroying their infrastructure, for destroying their oil refineries, for destroying their bridges and their hospitals and schools. And NATO is going to charge them for that. And then they're going to come in and say, okay, we're going to rebuild your country for you, and they'll charge them again. And so this is the kind of highway robbery that they're indulging in quite openly and blatantly.
Yeah, that's the best way, right, to be just completely brazen about it.
Absolutely.
Now, after all the good deeds I've done for you, you will have to pay. And it's going to involve, It's interesting. There will, as always, when we discuss Arab countries, African countries, the first subject is corruption. But the Americans operate a corrupt system that is unspeakable.
Exactly.
There are people like Blackwater who don't have to bid on a contract, but it's given to them, and it usually involves plane loads of American dollars that are taken off and passed out to various people.
Yes, of course.
I mean, they really... They could send the Arabs and Africans to school on how to be corrupt.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the Blackwater can still be considered a very minor affair. I mean, let's look at the U.S. internally. Like, you know, in 2008, when all these various financial scams were being operated in the U.S., the housing bubble and the hedge funds and the derivatives fraud, I mean, you know, George Bush sent his Treasury Secretary at the time, Henry Paulson, and Defense Secretary Robert Gates to Congress with a straightforward ultimatum. The congressmen were told that either you accept a bailout package of $750 billion to these banks and corporations that had involved in these Ponzi schemes and bankrupted themselves and the country, or Bush is going to declare martial law.
Mm-hmm.
And hear this. I mean, this is on record that Henry Paulson, who was the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, he was given full authority over how this $750 billion was going to be disbursed. So, of course, the congressman caved in, and Paulson awarded himself $500 million as bonus because he was the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. So this theft,
yes, you're right.
This theft is taking place right before our eyes within the U.S.
Yes. No,
and, you know, the people that are protesting, the Occupy Wall Street movement, this is the reason why these people are protesting. They're saying that you people are robbing us right in front of our eyes. You take our money away from us. The rich are not being taxed. You tax us to death. And then you say to us that this is democracy. So this is what is going on right over here. And billions of dollars have been stolen. And America has been bankrupted as a result of these kinds of Ponzi schemes and the casino economy that they are running.
Mm.
But in the past, of course, they would go to other countries and rob them. I mean, the two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were waged because the reason behind it was that we would get their resources to finance these wars. But that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
As a consequence of those two wars, America had to fork out something like $4 trillion. But now, of course, in Libya, they have come. This has been a relatively short campaign. The U.S. only spent about $1.1 billion on this. But now they are coming in fast and furious. They're going to recover their cost through Libyan oil and the other assets that they have stolen from Libya, because Libya is an extremely rich country.
Yeah.
And it had assets worth something like $135 billion. These were Libyan reserves in different countries, in Western banks. And all of this money, of course, has now come into the possession of the U.S., Britain, and France, the three countries that were leading this assault on Libya.
Yeah, the saintly trio.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. We're speaking with Zafar Benghesh, who knows whereof he speaks. Now, Zafar... The Toronto Star today is doing its sort of soft applause for isn't that touching that the people of Tunisia are peacefully going to vote. I want to know, you've been following the events there. They allegedly were the first in the so-called spring. I'm hearing reports that this election, the most interesting aspect of it, and this yesterday's New York Times reported on it, is that money from the Gulf states, but particularly Qatar, is behind one of the principal parties there. So in other words, are they adopting the 1% type of democracy practiced in Washington, United States? Or is it a broad democracy?
Well, you know, in Tunisia, of course, the whole democratic process is tightly controlled. I mean, we know that, you know, people were allowed to vote, but the way the whole thing was structured was that no party could emerge with a clear majority because there were more than 100 parties. And we know that Al-Nahda, which is the which is referred to as the Islamist Party, has won the plurality of votes. It has got more than 40% of the vote, but it still does not have a clear majority. But I want to, mention something else to you. The interim prime minister, who was basically chosen by the military back in February after General Bin Ali was forced to flee the country. The interim prime minister, his name is Deji Saeed Essebsi. He visited Washington, D.C. earlier this month. He was in Washington from October the 3rd to the 7th. And, when he was asked about the elections in Tunisia, the forthcoming elections, he said that, he compared the people to somebody who's hungry. You know, this is what he said, and I'm going to quote to you. This is from the Washington Post. He said, when somebody is hungry asking for food, you only give him what he needs. This is how the Washington Post quoted him. He said, you don't give him too much food, otherwise he'll die. So what he's saying is that you don't give these people too much freedom, otherwise they won't know how to handle it.
Yeah, see, this is an experienced eater, so he knows what happens.
Exactly,
to food.
Exactly. You see, so you see that the whole process that's taking place in Tunisia is tightly controlled, and the interim prime minister, he said, he was asked by the Washington Post, and he said, well, look, the religion of the people in Tunisia is Islam, but Tunisia would not become an Islamic republic. Now, how can he make that statement? He's not, the people haven't even voted at that time. So he's already making this declaration, and he said, no, we want to make sure that, these people get their freedom slowly. Otherwise, they're going to choke to death. They don't know how to handle freedom.
By the way, that's the language of colonialism.
Absolutely.
I can recall in the so-called decolonizing period, which has now passed, and we have entered the colonization period, but it was always said, well, of course, we'll have elections in Ghana when they're ready.
Exactly.
By the way, that was the same with African Americans.
That's right.
When they show they're ready, we'll give them freedom.
That's right. And this is what they are saying now, and he is assuring the Americans and others that he will make sure that they take a step-by-step approach, that these people do not get carried away with their notions of freedom, that Essebsi and the West are going to determine how much freedom is good for them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they think that freedom is not good for them, then we will withdraw that freedom from them. And incidentally, there are already, there have been a number of reports from Tunisians, and these have appeared, for instance, in the Guardian newspaper 2-3 days ago. Tunisians have written op-ed pieces saying that, going to Tunisia and seeing the situation, the same old faces are still back in control of everything. The police that were that had become a little circumspect and a little bit more careful in the early days after the overthrow of Bin Ali, they have resumed their swagger, and now they go around beating up people, and they've sort of resumed their old ways.
Mm-hmm.
So they said that we fear very little has changed in Tunisia, that there has simply been a change of face at the top.
Mm-hmm.
The hated dictator has been removed, but virtually his entire entourage and the people that propped him up over the 23 years of his rule and prior to that, when Bin Ali had served as the intelligence chief for Bourguiba, the other dictator,
mm-hmm.
that all of those people are still there, that they haven't left the levers of power, and they have very little intention of doing so.
They've got a new set of dark glasses, or changed their hats.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Yes. This is Zafar Benghash, and Zafar is very important to us. I think we have about 3 minutes left, but you are yourself from Pakistan originally. Listeners ought to remember that we are hearing talk of a confrontation, and they mean war, with the United States and Pakistan. And one admixture has been that the president of Afghanistan says, well, if that happens, I will fight for Pakistan.
That's correct,
I mean,
yes.
We are really entering a kind of strange world. What the heck is going on?
Absolutely. You see, what is happening is that obviously the American and NATO military occupation of Afghanistan is facing a very stiff resistance from the Afghan people. And the Americans cannot control the situation. The resistance has moved right into Kabul. As you know, last month, in fact, exactly a month ago, Burhanuddin Rabbani, who was the head of the Peace Council, was killed by somebody, you know, supposed to be a Taliban supporter, but the Taliban have denied that. But in any case, he was killed right in his home in Kabul. And I want to mention to you, I had actually met Rabbani a day before he died. I was at a conference and I had met him.
My goodness.
And we talked about the situation in Afghanistan. And he expressed to me great optimism about, you know, how he was making progress, etc.
Oh, my goodness.
Although he didn't tell me that, you know, he was waiting for a Taliban emissary or a so-called Taliban emissary. But in any case, the situation in Afghanistan obviously is getting more and more precarious for the Americans. And the Americans, instead of confronting the reality that faces them, they are now exerting pressure on Pakistan to do more for them. Now, in fact, Hillary Clinton was in Islamabad 2 days ago. They had meetings over there, and the Pakistanis made absolutely clear to Hillary Clinton, and she was, of course, accompanied by General Martin Dempsey, who is the new Chairman Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as General Petraeus, who is now the Director of CIA. The Pakistanis made absolutely clear to them that we are not going to fight your wars for you, that if you want to talk to the Taliban, we can arrange it for you, but the failure or success of those talks depends on you and the Taliban. We are not going to take responsibility for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Americans, of course, are threatening Pakistan with war. They say that, well, either you fight our war for us or we are going to start attacking you.
Amazing.
And a day before Clinton arrived in Islamabad, the Pakistani military chief, General Kiani, in a very pointed statement, he said, I will caution the Americans to think 10 times before they plan to attack Pakistan. The consequences are going to be quite grave for them. I mean, this is a very unusual statement for General Kiani to make because my information is that he's not a man of too many words. He keeps his thoughts to himself. He doesn't issue threats lightly, and when he does, he carries them out. I mean, he's that kind of a person. So I think the Americans are obviously trying to set up Pakistan for their failure, but I can see that if they were to attack Pakistan, I can immediately tell you, sure, there'll be a lot of destruction caused in Pakistan, but I doubt very much if very many American soldiers will come out alive from Afghanistan then.
Yes. I'm afraid you're probably right. And we also always want to say Pakistan is a nuclear power. It's not,
exactly.
not an ordinary country.
That's correct, yes.
Zafar Benghash, it's been very enlightening. We're sure grateful. It's terrible times